Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Knowing the human history behind any dish just makes it taste better. On this week's show, Dr. David Shields of the University of South Carolina shares his years of research on American culinarians, from caterers and chefs to restaurateurs. Then, Dara Goldstein, editor of the Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets, shares tasty tidbits from that definitive new tome. And we'll spend some time with French furniture whisperer Christophe Pourny before sitting down with Marie Saint-Brie for Le Diner Bleu in the dining room of her family's Chateau Beauchene in France's Loire River Valley. We're traveling the world for edible education on this week's Louisiana Eats. David Shields is the Carolina Distinguished Professor at the University of South Carolina. He's also one of the world's leading experts on Southern culinary history. His upcoming book, Culinarians, American Chefs, Caterers, and Restaurateurs, is the first ever biographical collection of chefs, caterers, and restaurateurs in America. We recently sat down with David to get a crash course on the famous chefs who put the Crescent City on the culinary map.
It's surprising, you know, people say that we're living in the age of the celebrity chef, and the lives of chefs are something which fascinate us, yet most people can't think of anyone before James Beard or Julia Child. In New Orleans, of course, you have Antoine.
Yes.
But how many people know Antoine's last name?
Well, you and I do.
Yes.
Alciatoire. And actually, it's my guess New Orleanians, a lot of them know. But outside of here, probably not too many. But
and Jean Galatoire also.
And in many ways, I do believe that Madame Begay, Elizabeth Kettering Dutre Begay, I think was pretty close to maybe having been forgotten. But luckily, she's really back with a bang.
She was a national celebrity in the 1890s and on to her death. You had almost a genre of writing called, you know, the breakfast story, where some visitor from often celebrities came down to New Orleans, sat down for the 2.5 hours there consuming that breakfast, and then writing these rhapsodies afterwards.
Madame Begay is, of course, the one who's credited with having created what was called the butcher's breakfast. But it appears that there's a lot of people who jumped on her bandwagon. Tell me about some of the other breakfasts that were so important here that you discovered in your work.
It's true that there's a moment in the 1870s when this late breakfast served at 11 o'clock in the morning becomes a fixture. Madame Begay is the one who starts it, but shortly thereafter, Maria Sparbe at Maley's becomes as famous, but there's a difference. She lives longer than Madame Begay. And Maley's is an all-male preserve. You have to know someone to get in to the brunch at Maley's until Prohibition takes place, and they have to alter the conditions to stay alive. But that becomes, in the wake of Madame Begay's death, the famous breakfast in the city.
Well, another thing that is just undoubtedly part of the Louisiana culture are oyster bars, oyster saloons.
Well, Walter Van Rensselaer was not a native of New Orleans. He was a New Yorker from the Hudson Valley. He's in New Orleans in the late 1830s, but he had experienced certain things on the East Coast. One of them is the oyster cellars that were popular in the 18-teens and 20s and 30s in Philadelphia and Baltimore, and to a lesser extent, New York City. He comes down here and becomes one of the great hotel chefs. And the hotel chefs are, they have a real problem. A lot of their clientele are these cotton farmers from the Mississippi Valley who are coming down and staying in the hotel during the commercial season. A lot of these commercial men were meat and potato people. And yet you had a population of French cuisine-loving residents that you had to depend on during the non-commercial seasons. Mm-hmm. Was there any category of food which appealed to both populations?
And it was the oyster?
The oyster was the universal donor.
Amazing.
And when he realizes that, he thinks, if I concentrate on the oyster and not have to worry about feeding multitudes of families and people in a major restaurant, I can make so much more money and enjoy so much more success with so much less exertion. So he opens up this extraordinary oyster restaurant. The success of Van Rensselaer's restaurant leads to this explosion. Within 2 years in the 1840s, instead of just having one oyster restaurant, you had about seven or eight. And other people like the Estrados, who are making names as oyster saloon people.
Antonio Estrado was also really innovative because in months with R's, when certainly people weren't eating oysters back then, he had another game. What was his other game?
One of the things that Estrado took advantage of, ice warehouses began to appear in New Orleans in the 1820s. And actually causes sort of the ice cream moment, mm-hmm. when all of a sudden the cold confection becomes the best thing you could possibly eat.
Of course.
And Estrado realizes that ice is important. He becomes one of the big ice dealers as well. But he leaves. He leaves the city and actually winds up in San Francisco.
But he leaves his brother, John Estrado, behind, who goes on to do something really important at the Excelsior Oyster Saloon, doesn't he?
That's right. He creates, I guess they called them oyster rolls back then, but perhaps you could elaborate on this history.
Well, it's definitely the poor boy sandwich. And yet, what's really fabulous is that you have been able to directly trace not just what we know today is the oyster poor boy, which he was calling the oyster roll, but the peacemaker.
Yes. This is the thing you brought back to your household when you have not understood the wisdom of your spouse.
So there are so many women in this business, which to me is another fascinating thing about this time. Tell me about some of the other women. For instance, Madame Eugene.
Yes, Madame Eugene was probably the greatest chef in New Orleans in the 1880s.
Now that's a big throwdown because, of course, that's in direct competition with Madame Begay.
Well, it is, but you have to consider that the greatest restaurant in the eyes of the people in the 1880s was Moreau's. Mm-hmm. It and Victor's restaurant, the restaurant owned by the Martine family, vied with one another for the title of preeminence. And you'll have all of these debates in the newspaper about which is the finer.
Just like today. So they are serving a dinner. They are not just, it's a lot more than just the butcher's breakfast.
It is. And what's particularly interesting about it, we tend to think of New Orleans cuisine as being Creole cuisine, but it's evident that that title doesn't become popular until the 1890s. Someone like Madame Begay considers herself a French chef, And she doesn't really notice the kind of local accommodation she's making. For instance, when she makes her famous crawfish bisque, which was considered the standard recipe for that dish in the city, the creme de riz, the rice flour binder that she's getting from using the Creole rice in Louisiana, different than what's being used in Paris. It's something that's local practice. So we have a French cuisine that is becoming increasingly Louisiana, and she is, in maybe an unconscious way, absorbing into her formal training, which occurred in Alsace in the 1850s, early 1850s, she's taking local practice and embracing it.
There are Black women, too. I find the story of Nellie Murray particularly compelling because she began life as a slave.
She did indeed. And after general liberation of the slaves, the Hebert family connections secure her a job in one of the high society households in New Orleans. And it's there that she learns the other dimension of catering, that is, how to set a table, how to arrange for the maximum pleasurable experience of a group of guests brought together for an evening from first to last, how to manage like a field marshal.
She also, at one time, travels with one of the people who she was the chef de cuisine for. She travels to Europe, and she has a really incredible experience in Europe, doesn't she?
I think it's the temptation of going to Paris.
Yeah, I'd be tempted. I'm always tempted to go to Paris.
And she goes there, and she has this extraordinary moment of recognition. She sees the techniques. The ingredients are different. But she understands in a very intuitive way that this is the cooking that she does.
Well, David, I just have to say thank you so much for sharing the most delicious research I've heard in a long time with us.
Well, it's fun to share it with you, Poppy, because you know exactly what's so interesting about these people who devote their lives professionally to the preparation of the best food for the public.
Well, I love it. New Orleans loves it. All of Louisiana loves it. So thank you, David.
No, thank you for talking to me.
David Shields, Carolina Distinguished Professor at the University of South Carolina. What is a celebration cake, and what's its history? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. Don't go anywhere. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. I just want to celebrate another day of living. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What is a celebration cake, and what's its history? The Great Cake, as it was originally called in 16th century England, was baked in the huge ovens of the country manor houses. Often weighing as much as 35 pounds, the cake was always stuffed full of currants and iced with the sugar and egg white frosting. The Great Cake came to America with the earliest English settlers, where by the 1700s in Hartford, Connecticut's colonial court, it became known as election cake. Americans of the 1800s transformed the Great Cake into what we'd call today the fruitcake, and it was served at weddings, birthdays, funerals, and of course at holiday time. To learn more about the celebration cake and all things sweet, pick up a copy of the Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets, available in bookstores everywhere. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Oxford University's companion series are encyclopedic compendiums on subjects ranging from art, religion, history, and even food. This year, Oxford University released the Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets, which was compiled and edited by my good friend Dara Goldstein. Full disclosure, I'm not just a fan of this new book, I'm also one of the contributors. Dara did me the honor of asking me to write the entry about the New Orleans tradition of sweets. Recently, we spoke with Dara over the phone to learn more about how this amazing tome came together. Dara, I am so glad to have this opportunity to talk with you on Louisiana Eats because Oxford University produces these amazing companions, and some of them are based on literature, and some of them, Lord, one of them is on the Bible. But I find it particularly fascinating that there's a companion of food, wine, Italian food, and now sugar and sweets. Would you sort of give us a walk through what you'll find in the new Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets?
Yeah, you'll find the whole history of humanity, which I know it sounds like a gross overstatement, but it's really looking at civilization through the prism of the sweet, because if you think about sugar more than any other foodstuff, it has influenced the way the world and trade and desire and all of these human attributes have developed. So it looks at specific foodstuffs that are sweet, not just sugar, but also other sweeteners, including honey and artificial sweeteners. It looks at the equipment and the technology that have been devised over the centuries to refine sugar and to create all kinds of different desserts. It has a geographic sweep of looking at sweet things throughout the world and also throughout time. It is, I think, quite strong in science, which was important to me, looking at physiology and also at botany and, most interesting to me, neuroscience and the way sweet affects us and travels into our brain and our sensory receptors there. Religion, spirituality, pastry chefs who have created extraordinary sculptures over the years. I could just go on and on.
Dara, that's such an interesting concept to view civilization through the prism of sweet. You know, of course, that's a sugar crystal, so the prism, all of that rings true. Would you speak a little more on that?
Yes. From the very first, we humans have been designed in terms of evolution to desire things that are sweet in order to sustain life. So if you think about the early foragers, and these are not the people who are going out now foraging because it's trendy, you know, it's really just to survive. They looked and they saw bright red fruits, and that signaled that the fruits were ripe and therefore would provide quick energy. Also, foods that tasted bitter were likely toxic, whereas foods that had a sweeter taste, again, were bound to provide more energy. So we've been hardwired to like sweets. So if you start from that point and you start thinking about desire and how sugar was initially a luxury food, it was also initially a medicine prescribed in Ayurvedic medicine and ancient Chinese medicine, then in Western tradition of humoral medicine, it was considered very beneficial because it was both heating and moistening. So if you had congestion, that spoonful of sugar was the medicine and not just helping other medicine go down. So it was a status symbol, and when it became more available, due to the rise of sugar plantations and the slave trade, it became quite pervasive, and people started using it to detrimental effect, as we find now. So you can trace the history of medicine, of human health. It's one way of looking at it through the lens of sugar.
It is an extraordinary tome, just as all the companions are. Dara, I would like you to tell me about how you even approached this. How long in the making was this book, and how do you even tackle a project like that?
Puppy, you know me, and you know that I tend to have obsessions. And I have to say that once I decide to do this, I did it with alacrity, and I think it was about 2.5 years. Originally, Oxford had asked me to do a companion to World Food, and I just didn't feel that I could do justice to that.
Mm-hmm.
It would mean making choices about which civilization and its sweets were better than another, inevitably making enemies around the world. And I just didn't feel that it could be comprehensive enough. But I started thinking about what I really like, and I have quite a sweet tooth. And I thought, well, there's an interesting way to think about world food. And I started out, I'd say, thinking geographically about what countries do have the strongest traditions and what some of their most iconic desserts are. And within the United States, then thinking about regions. Of course, that's where you came in as the most wonderful person to be able to write about New Orleans and the extraordinary sweets culture there. I didn't want this to be a ponderous volume. I wanted it to be fun to read and to dip into. So there's a lot about slang, about sexual euphemisms, using sweet terms.
How many contributors are there? Because this is gargantuan.
There are 265. And, you know, it could have been a smaller number, but I actually wanted as many voices as possible. I didn't want it to, you're not supposed to read it from beginning to end.
No, it's not like a novel.
So I wanted a sense of variety and different voices.
Well, it's a beautiful project, and I really want to congratulate you on, 2.5 years. That alone is quite impressive, Dara. Congratulations.
You haven't seen me in a while, Poppy, so I have more gray hair than I did when you last saw me.
Well, I hope that we can change that soon, and we'll see you down south here with us in New Orleans.
I would love that. Thank you so much.
Dara Goldstein, editor of the Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets. What's known as the ooey gooey cake is a southern gas station staple where squares of that sinful sweet lie in wait for you right next to the cash register. The buttery cake was invented by accident during the Great Depression when a German-American baker in St. Louis, Missouri mistakenly reversed the proportions of butter and flour in a classic cake batter. When the cake came out of the oven, it was out of the question to throw it out. So the botched effort was sold and became an instant hit. Boxed cake mix. Boxed cake mix makes the ooey gooey cake easy to throw together, and it's, well, ooey gooiness is sure to make it a family favorite at your house soon. You can find an ooey gooey cake recipe in Jill Benson's cookbook, Fun, Funky, and Fabulous. And on our Louisiana Eats website at wwno.org and itsneworleans.com. I'm Poppy Tooker, and Ooey Gooey Cake is real Louisiana Eats.
Happy and real, you got your own appeal, and you're a sweet thing, you're sure a sweet thing. I said a sweet thing.
For For Christophe Pourny, preserving antique furniture is much more than a craft. It's a calling. Learning antique restoration from a young age in his father's antique shop in the south of France, Christophe has become a revered furniture historian and conservator over the past 20 years. Christophe recently visited our Louisiana Eats studio to share his new book, The Furniture Bible, and evangelize the gospel and history of dining room furniture.
So I am Christophe Pourny, and I am an antique restorer, antique conservation. I've always done that. So when people ask me, where did you learn? Where I didn't learn. I was born in an antique store in France. My parents were antique dealers. So it's in my gene. It's a passion. I try to get rid of it. I tried to get rid of it, you know, to shake it off. But I can't. It's impossible. It always catches me back, you know. So
you just can't get away from that pull of refinishing the antique furniture.
Antiques is really a passion. I mean, old stuff. It's really unbelievable what you can find and what you can deal with.
Each piece really sort of tells its own story, doesn't it?
Because it's unique. Everything is unique. And I think it's very important nowadays where everything is standard, normalized, everything is bought from big chains of furniture or as good as they are, you know. But everybody should have one piece that is unique, that you have at home and where you can look at it when you come back at night from work and you're tired and tell you, I'm the only one right now that has this piece of furniture in the world.
Well, in this day of do-it-yourself with everybody developing new hobbies and doing things that perhaps previously they would have hired craftsmen to do, you have written sort of the ultimate do-it-yourself book about caring for antique furniture, and it's called The Furniture Bible. What did it take to write a Bible, Christophe?
Oh, you have to be inspired from above.
It's a beautiful book.
Thanks. I actually, when I approached the publisher, I wanted to do something a little more precise, and she's the one that told me, no, Christophe, you know, with the knowledge you have, you really have to go big and start, you know, to do something that is going to get you from the history of the piece, from knowing your piece of furniture to how to buy it, how to deal with it, how to maintain it, take care of before and after. And the project got bigger and bigger and longer, and we ended up with a Bible.
Well, I'd like to focus on the dining room.
The dining room.
After all, the name of the show is Louisiana
Eats. Yes,
so everybody knows that sooner or later it all comes down
to food.
To food with me.
And well, with French people also. So.
So what is your favorite style of table for dining?
The favorite style of dining table is and has to be a 19th century table. Why? Because this is about the 1850s that really the dining room and the dining experience we know nowadays really, really started to exist. Before, it was a little bit all over the place. People had small table on the sides. People had rooms that were not dining rooms, the hall, the side rooms or whatever. The parlor initially was a dining room. Used as a dining room. That's where it started. Parlor is from the French, parler, to speak. And when the kings and when the royalty, you know, starting not to want to have dinners in this big banquet hall, you know, in front of everybody, they retired to a small room on the side because they could parler, they could speak a little more privately, and that became the parlor eventually.
Yeah. I didn't know that. That's a wonderful thing to know.
And then, again, once the parlor, dining, living existed, the two rooms separated. They're like, okay, wait, we can do even better. One that is going to become the living room, the parlor, and one that is going to be just for dining. So the servants can set it up, clean it up, and we don't have to entertain ourselves, you know, and our guests around the table for the entire duration of the evening. 19th century, a room is starting to be designed as a formal dining room, used only for that. And the style of furniture, of course, the table and the chairs, are going to be designed specially for dining. So a good Victorian, I know there's always a bad rap about Victorian furniture, but a good Victorian dining table is the best thing you can have as a dining table. It's sturdy. It gets bigger with nice leaves. It has a mechanism that still can work. It has the right height. It's the right proportions. If you want a dinner, you better have a 19th century table or even later, but they are going to be copied on the same concept.
Would you give us a little walk through the history of chair design?
Yes. People have always needed to sit somewhere. Weirdly enough, people need to sleep and to eat, but beds have not always existed and dining tables neither. But there have always been seats. And they started from the most simple structures of planks joined with rustic nails or rustic kind of knots, you know, to some very, very elaborate forms and shape and design. As time evolved and times got more refined and more peaceful and richer, so through the evolution of the chair, you really have almost the evolution of humanity and history for the past 2,000 years, from medieval times where everything got very rough at the fall of the Roman Empire, through medieval times, through Renaissance, Classical Age, 18th century, 19th century. And you really historically tell, oh, this is why this style was at this precise time because of. And the chair follows, you know, like the shape and the historic events almost years by years.
Give me a specific example of one of your favorite chairs and why the chair is the way it is.
Well, it is true. Everything moves together in history. If I say that fashion moves in parallel of history or social movements, I don't think it's going to shock anybody. People would be pretty, yes, okay, I can understand that, and we see that. But if I say what I just said about furniture, people are going to be more like, how is the leg of a furniture has to do with history? So if you put the two together, you can see that, oh yeah, actually it does. And you ask me about a type of furniture, a type of chair. So, for example, if we take three kings that followed each other, Louis XIV, Louis XV, Louis XVI, the one that got his head cut. So it started with Louis XIV, which is a very powerful, absolute, regal monarch that liked things, of course, being a big ego guy, sturdy, ornated, very, very massive. So we have a lot of gilt, a lot of scrolls, a lot of rich materials. The lines are very rich. Same thing in fashion. You have a lot of ribbons, a lot of lace, a lot of brocart, embroidery. So if you put the two of them together, you find a similitude in lines and in decorations. Then, of course, as always, a kind of a reaction after the death of Louis XIV. Oh, no, enough with that. We want things lighter. We want things a little more refined. We want things that have a little more subtlety. So in fashion, you get the ribbons get a little finer, a little less heavy. No lace anymore, just a white stocking and a very, very simple eau de chausse, like the pants. And, well, it follows also in the leg of the chair. The leg of the chair becomes the beautiful cabriole with this beautiful, you know, simple movement and elegant, you know. So that follows. And then after you have Louis XVI, another reaction, enough of the curves and a little more sturdiness, but very, very simple. This is the age of neoclassical. This is the moment where they rediscovered Pompeii, for example. So you have a taste for antique, a taste for simple lines, a taste for like light floral elements. So same thing, the fashion becomes a little more simple. Everything is plain color. Everything is like straight lines. And if you look at the chair, this is the moment where you get the straight fluted leg, where you get straight decorations, stripes, enough of the curves and the elegant lines. So you can really, really, really follow this way. And if you continue afterwards with Napoleon and Victorian age and whatever, you can continue the comparison.
In your experience, how different is the style in America between mm-hmm. northern homes and southern homes?
There is, in the sense that historically the South has always been more traditional, and the North more, I don't want to say innovative, but they were always at the arrow point, you know, of new techniques, new styles. And let's face it, it always has also an economical side. It's because you want to create new furniture so you can sell new furniture and you can make more money. And you can. So the styles were changed much faster in terms of furniture in the North, when here people had traditional furniture, more European style furniture, artisan that were recreating the same lines. So you have more European style furniture here, and more specifically American styles in the North, like Federal, like American Empire, and all those Dutch colonial, all those things, you know, that the first settlers came there, everything was from there. Here, everything went straight almost to French provincial, even Anglo-Indian, you know, like South England furniture. And it's so that's the difference, you know, between the two styles and the two conception, North and South.
Christoph, it was such a treat to have you and your great expertise in our Louisiana Eats
studio. It was a treat for me to be here. I always love to come to New Orleans and see you every time and talk about furniture, talk about food, and ask you for the best place to eat every time in New Orleans.
Christoph Pourny, author of The Furniture Bible. When we come back from a short break, we're traveling to Chateau Beauchesne in the Loire River Valley to experience the Dinner Bleu with Marie St. Brie. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets.
Sur la plage abandonnée, coquillages et crustacés, qui l'eût cru déplore la perte de l'été, qui depuis s'en est allé.
Recently, I had the extreme honor of being a guest at Chateau Beauchesne in the Loire River Valley. Beauchesne has been the summer and holiday home of the St. Brie family for many generations. To welcome the guests, Marie St. Brie decided to host a Dîner Bleu, a dinner party with an intense blue theme. I arrived to find Marie hard at work in the dining room, setting an exquisite table with the finest of French accessories, of course, all in blue.
And introduce yourself.
Marie Saint-Brice. Ah. Merci. Thank you so much for inviting us into your beautiful home here at Beauchesne. And tonight, you're hosting a very special dinner. Tell me about the dinner.
Well, as Beauchesne is in the Loire Valley with such a blue sky, I thought it would be fantastic to put the blue in in light. And I decided to do a table as my grandmother did for her friends, guests, and family. So I will do the Dîner Bleu. The blue dinner in English. And just for fun, I decide to put some different glasses, blue glasses and blue and white plates, like we could do in the Compagnie des Indes in the 18th century, which is the time when was built our house, Beauchesne.
Beauchesne is so beautiful, and I'm going to follow you as you set the table. And tell me a little bit about the dinnerware. Tell me about the tablecloth, the decanters. It's all
It's so beautiful and so many shades of blue.
Yes. So on the table, I made a mix of the Portuguese blue and white plates. And we have the chance to have a lot of blue and white of the 18th century in our house. So I decided to gather some old piece with new pieces, you know. And then as my grandmother was doing blue dinners, sometimes she was also doing blue food. I decided to make it more and more blue, you know, much and much. So I found in our other castle in the Clos Lucés where Leonardo da Vinci lived, I found that we had still some blue containers, crystal blue containers, and I bring them for the party tonight, you know. So it adds something little too much, you know, there is a little too much blue. And I think when you do tableware, it's nice to do something with just this little too much, which makes the table glitter, like, and it's party time, you know. As this house is 18th century, all that blue remind us all the Silk Road, all the Asian interest that the 18th century French people had for trip. Le Grand Voyage, La Chinoiserie. It was a way to make a very beautiful table. It was a way to receive your guest at his best. So tonight we have the chance to have American people, a lot of people from New Orleans who are extremely interested by French culture because it's their own culture too. And tonight I want to make a revival of this 18th century, which is in all our heads, like a phantasmagory, like a part of our imagination.
It's so beautiful at the table. And if you would describe for me, so which are old family pieces? How long has this been in your family? What's the provenance of the pieces on the table?
Well, first, at the center, you have a beautiful Compagnie des Indes blue and white soup container with a beautiful fruit on the top, and on the edges, two animals looking at us, you know. This is an 18th century piece coming from our castle of the Clos Lucé, and we have that since the 19th century in our family, surely. And all the containers, the crystal blue containers, are also from the Saint-Brice family, from our family, since the 19th century, as I take them in the place where they, in the closet of the Clos Lucé, you know, especially for tonight.
And you've decorated the room with not just the beautiful dinnerware and the beautiful blue crystal decanters. Tell me what special you have taken out to decorate the room.
Well, I like always to make something a little funny, you know, not too much serious, you know, not only a table which is well done. I think it's very important to do something with some gloss, something like a little, in French we say, something un petit peu mauvais goût, a little bad taste, you know, because this gives much more fun to the table and also to the conversation. So I decide to take a dog that we have under a big armoire, and normally he's there and very big silver basket looking at us from the top. But this time I decide to put it on a Dutch expert furniture, which is already a very special piece. And I put this dog, which is in Celadon porcelain of the 18th century, coming from China. It's the name of... what the name of the dog?
It's my favorite dog. Anybody who knows me knows that I'm very fond of the Chinese pug. And there you have, sitting on that beautiful sideboard, an aqua-colored sort of Chinese pug with big brown realistic eyes. And Marie, he's wearing a turban.
Yes, I thought with a turban, he's giving the idea of the party, you know. He's helping us to get out of our normal mind and going in our imagination. So I found a turban, a very beautiful silk turban, and it's blue, dark blue, orange, Turkish blue, and I decided it was not enough, you know. I put also a very big heart on the turban with diamond and emerald, plus some roses from the garden. And like that, he's splendid. He's looking at the table and he is waiting us for the dinner.
It's the most wonderful, delightful little piece of folly. It truly is. Mm. Well, I would be remiss if I didn't ask one more question before I let you get back to your table setting.
Yes.
So this evening, when the light outside the chateau fades and all of your guests gather under this incredible chandelier.
Yes.
Would you tell me about the chandelier?
Yes, the chandelier is very interesting because, you know, it's all of crystal little bowls and crystal pearls, and when you put the light on it, it glitters. It's like Christmas time, you know. And this chandelier, it's my brother Jack that I loved so much and who died some years ago, who found it in an auction sale, because we had another chandelier, all in bronze, but it was less party-like. And this chandelier is there as if it has always been there now.
It is, and with all of those beautiful shining balls that are like little bubbles.
Yeah.
It's almost like they came out of the champagne bottle and headed.
Exactly, exactly. And all the light, it is made so that the light is coming on the bowls, and then that the light has to be can reflect very quickly away, you know. So it's so festive.
Well, I'm going to leave you to set your table.
Thank you.
I will rejoin you this evening at
the
Blue Dinner.
Thank you so much for being there. It's lovely to have you at home.
If Marie Saint-Brie whetted your appetite for all things French, tune in next week for our All French, All the Time, Poppy Goes to Paris. I'm Poppy Tooker, and this is Louisiana Eats. This month's Louisiana Eats and Cooks Club is going to be fun, funky, and fabulous with Jill Benson, author of the new book by the same name. We'll get the party started at 6:30 on Thursday, September the 24th at Rouse's Culinary Innovation Center at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Jill and I will be cooking up some delicious dishes from the book, and Brady's Wine Warehouse will provide the wine and the wine education. You'll find the link for tickets on the Southern Food and Beverage Museum's website at southernfood.org and on our Louisiana Eats website at itsneworleans.com. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Come along with me next week for the ultimate foodie vacation in the Loire River Valley and Paris.
Okay.
Bonjour, madame.
Bonjour.
La production Bordeaux.
That's so good.
I know.
Yeah, it's really, why would you have to cook?
You don't have to, ever.
Amazing.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Dickie Brennan's Bourbon House, from oysters to redfish, serving fresh Gulf seafood on Bourbon Street. They're also home to the city's largest American whiskey and bourbon collection. Our original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Chris Kehoe, and Sarah Holtz. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.